This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us today for Talk Louisiana. And we begin our discussion today about higher education, which has been on the chopping block in Louisiana for about a decade. We now spend as a state $700 million less in money than we did in 2008. And that's, of course, not adjusting for inflation. This on higher education. And with us to talk about it are two people from the Louisiana State University system in Shreveport, Dr. Jeff Sadow, who writes a weekly column for The Advocate and has degrees from Vanderbilt, Oklahoma, and UNO. And in studio, Kevin Cope, who for the last 10 years has been faculty senate president, just stepped down from that post. He's been at the LSU campus, the main campus now, since 1983. 877-217-5757 is your number. 877-217-5757 in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. And email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Let's start with you, Dr. Jeff Sadow. The situation is such that most people on college campuses here are not happy, and perhaps for good reason, but is it as dire as it has been proclaimed to be?
Well, if you look at actually the overall amount of money that's being spent for higher education, and we go back to, well, let's say 9 years, at least the data, one data we have is a year old. So let's go back to the beginning of the Jindal administration to the first year of the Edwards administration. Now, higher education is not spending as much. It's about, about $100 million fewer, maybe, when you look at all sources. The mix has changed, certainly. Much less state aid, much more reliance on self-generated funds. I think when you do the math, it ends up being about an 8% decline in total money being spent by higher education. And as, again, you point out, that doesn't include inflation. And another adjustment you have to make is student credit hours, which is down a little bit over that nine-year period. So basically, yeah, you're looking at a cut, but it's not the end of the world. Let's put it that way.
Why is it not the end of the world?
Well, a lot of people, again, are going around bemoaning how there's just been these disastrous cuts to higher education, and there have been cuts. But, again, if we look at it in percentage terms, even adjusting for inflation, you're looking, again, raw dollars around 8%, but then you've thrown inflation. That's going to add several percentage points more. So, yes, it's a cut, but, a number of sources exaggerate what that cut is. And again, it's a cut, but it's not a dramatic, drastic cut.
Dr. Kevin Cope, with two degrees from Harvard by way of Pitzer College in his home state of California, has been at the Old War School now for 34 years. What do you make of these cuts?
Well, I was interested, Jim, in your use of the term dire. The use of the term dire is really a public relations and political term. There hasn't been very much dire since Caesar was knocked off in the Roman Empire, I suppose. But I would point out a couple of things following what Professor Sadow had to say. One is that in addition to the numerical decline in the number of dollars out there, there's also been, of course, inflation, which has increased the cost of the universities, and then there has been the gradual transfer of financial responsibility for the universities to the people in the form of tuition. Tuition could also be called a tax, I suppose, by some folks, because it's a payment for the support of a public agency, but there you have that. And then you also have the fact that there are runaway imposed expenses on the university. For example, the swelling in the obligation to pay for the problematic retirement system and all of the other expenses that are involved in operating any other large physical and personnel-oriented business, from maintenance on to electrical power, and, of course, simply to providing the basic equipment necessary to operate a large business or facility.
877-217-5757 is your number if you'd like to engage Dr. Kevin Cope in studio here in Baton Rouge, where he teaches now a professor of English for 34 years at LSU, and Dr. Jeff Sadow, who's been at LSU Shreveport for how many years now, Dr. Sadow?
27.
27 years. So you both like where you are, I would think, or you wouldn't be here so long, but both of you have battled budget cuts and have different perspectives on what it's done to higher education overall. And, of course, it's not just an LSU story. It's a story on college campuses throughout the state. Jim and Walker. Good morning, Jim. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, Jim. We're both on. I would like to disagree with Dr. Cope in principle. He's correct that the end is not nigh. The problem is that the end has already arrived, and it came and went back during the Jekyll administration when the cuts to higher education and the wage freezes caused all of our premier research scientists who were bringing in money into the university with all of their federal grants, they left. They're gone. And that's when we almost lost our land and sea grant. So while you may want to, you know, dance around on the head of a pin about numbers right now, we've already had the worst happen at LSU. And what's going on now is not helping it recover in any way, shape, or form.
Well, thank you, sir. I think that you don't really disagree with me. I think you're just helping me in my lifelong campaign to be a little less polite than I ought to be. And certainly among the devastations that have been wrought are exactly what you said. That is, in addition to the university losing its financial support to some extent from the government and from the people, it's also lost some levels of its prestige. That is, it's not able to engage in such large and important and life-transformative projects as it once did. And this is because, of course, granting agencies become more suspicious of a university that's financially unstable. We have faculty flight on the LSU A&M campus. We've lost nearly 300 faculty members in the last 3 or 4 years. So, yes, I certainly agree with you that this devastation has occurred. Is the university going to close tomorrow? No. You say I'm dancing on the head of the pin. Part of the reason is that we in the universities can't figure out exactly how to dance. If we explain how serious the problem is, it aggravates the supporting public. And if we don't, then it seems like everything is fine and dandy.
Dr. Sadow, Bobby Jindal, our former governor, has taken much of the brunt of criticism for cuts to higher education. Do you think that is deserved?
Again, there have been cuts, and Jindal, of course, was with partnering with the legislature, was the one who put out the budgets to do that, and they're the ones that went along with it. So. Certainly, he's, you know, if there's, quote, blame, then he's one of the prime suspects. Again, whether this is that traumatic, that's debatable. I mean, we look at 10 years ago, 9 years ago, what the state of funding of higher education was in Louisiana. And in those days, and if you go back even a few years before that, Louisiana had one of the highest per capita or per student state aid of any state in the country, and it had one of the lowest tuition rates, or again, if you put it in per student or per capita terms, one of the lowest among the states. 10 years from now, the money total from both is a little bit lower, but the balance has been changed dramatically. Now we find that in terms of tuition, Louisiana has moved up almost towards the middle spot of states in terms of per capita tuition. And in terms of state spending, it's moved down a little below the middle. So actually, roughly, I think, around 85.85, something like that, if one's the baseline for a typical state. So, if that disturbs you, then yes, Jindal is certainly to blame for that shift in financing sources. But again, in overall totals, it's, again, not that dramatic of a drop.
Chuck and Scott. Chuck, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Drs. Cope and Sadow.
Good morning. I'm in higher education, and I think Dr. Cope is known for his dry sense of humor and is perhaps understating the problem with tongue-in-cheek, and I think Dr. Sadow's, painting a rosy picture of the events. If you look at the facts, Louisiana students and parents of those students have had to accept a much larger burden in the last 10 years, and the faculty have had to accept a much larger burden in the last 10 years. I know at UL Lafayette, faculty have received 3 raises in the last 10 years, but there hasn't been a year gone by where we haven't had to pay more for health care and other costs. All our costs have gone up, but the salaries have not. Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. Have you gotten three raises in the last 10 years?
Well, there have been three raises administered in the LSU system. However, they have not gone to all LSU campuses. That's a subtle difference. There are eight campuses plus a few institutes in the LSU system, and only a handful of them have gotten those raises. They've also been given irregularly and in very small amounts, mm-hmm. and sometimes on irrational grounds. So this caller is quite correct. That is, we've got faculty running away, and that costs money to replace them as well.
877-217-5757, Dr. Jeff Sadow in Shreveport at LSU, and Dr. Kevin Cope in Baton Rouge at LSU. And we're back after this time out on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. Valley Baltazar is producing, and our guests are Dr. Jeff Sadow, 27 years professor at Louisiana State University in Shreveport. He's a noted political scientist, and his columns appear each Sunday in The Advocate. And Dr. Kevin Cope, who arrived at LSU in 1983 when he was a young lad, I think of 25, fresh from 2 degrees from Harvard University, where he received his PhD. And for a decade, he was head of the Faculty Senate up until just a few weeks ago, and now he is past president. 877-217-5757 is your number, and if you're dialing in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, and the email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Dr. Sadow, we were talking about professors not getting raises. Has that been the case at LSU Shreveport as well?
Dr. Cope's correct. The different campuses will do different things in the system. We've received in 10 years one raise. And it was, you spoke of maybe there was a rationality to it. In our case, it was just flat, 2%. So, you know, there's no merit, apparently, or for the most part, didn't play a role in it. So, yeah, one time.
Well, it's a case in which morale has been an issue, but yet you are two examples. Our friend Hugh Buckingham at LSU used to call it the brain remain, not the brain drain, but the brain remain. Some of the professors stayed despite the turmoil. Kevin Cope, how do you explain that?
Well, I think there are a couple of explanations. One is that there are many faculty members who, over the course of years, develop connections, personal relationships, or perhaps come to like the culture of Louisiana. Another is that the academic job market is highly uneven. That is, there are some fields, petrochemical engineering, chemistry, whatever, that have a big market that have competition from the private sector, and those are where you see the most faculty flight. There are other areas, foreign languages, music, history, perhaps zoology, where there's not so much competition, and where especially a senior professor who's drawing a larger salary is going to have a harder time finding another opportunity.
And I would think both of you have tenure, correct?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm a lifer.
Yeah. The way it works is if you don't achieve it after a certain number of years, you're asked to move along. So that we've been there for such a long time would indicate, yeah, we've got tenure.
But if you were to move to another university, that would be part of the deal, wouldn't it, that you would get tenure at that school?
Well, yeah, at a senior level, it would be typically. You know, another thing that we can throw in there as far as the academic job market and why things are happening the way they are is the tremendous growth in distance learning, or what we normally associate as online education. It's really changed the landscape of higher education. If as far as traditional institutions like ours, that's been a major challenge to maintain basically enrollment in these kinds of environment. That certainly makes it more difficult for faculty to move along, although in some cases it might encourage them to move along.
All right, here's a question from Ada asking about TOPS and how that has changed the environment on the campuses that you work. Let's start with you, Dr. Cope.
Yes, TOPS is an interesting phenomenon. It's perhaps not widely known, but campuses benefit differentially from TOPS. There are campuses where there are high-achieving students in greater number and where there are a greater number of TOPS students. Strangely, when there's a cut to TOPS, those are the very campuses that get hurt the worst. In other words, the ones with the very best students get slammed the hardest. Now, here I will point out something in that TOPS is really kind of bureaucratically top-heavy. That is, we've got a situation where the legislature appropriates money, then it goes to students through TOPS and through another bureaucracy, and then it's paid back in the form of tuition. I personally have a rather radical view of this, that it's not really the most efficient model to finance universities through student tuition. Creates big student recruitment bureaucracies, for one. If we were simply to give something like a block grant or some other form of funding the university, and take the emphasis off tuition, then we might see a game changer. We would have students who would be motivated to meet admissions requirements, and then we would have less waste in all these bureaucracies, whether the processing of TOPS or the pursuit of students to pump up the tuition income.
What's your view on TOPS, Dr. Sadow?
To be a little more radical, maybe what could be done is to make TOPS basically a voucher, and completely get rid of direct state appropriations to universities. Simply give it all essentially to the student. Let the student make the choice. But you know, that's never going to happen in Louisiana. TOPS, you know, it is interesting the way that it differentially affects campuses. When it was instituted fully in the late 1990s, we actually began to see a drain from our campus towards the Baton Rouge campus, because now you had students that in the past from our area who could have, you know, maybe the best they could do was afford tuition at LSUS, and so they needed to stay in the area, stay at home, and save on living expenses and the like. So they go to LSUS, but suddenly with TOPS, tuition is taken care of. And so they have money now that they could spend on living arrangements elsewhere, and so they filtered out of the metropolitan area, Shreveport-Bossier, and went to other places. So we actually, in terms of enrollment, we took a hit as a result of TOPS, as people circulated, because we're one of the third tier, what are called the regional schools, and the few schools that are in the two higher tiers, we saw kind of a drain, so to speak, going to them.
877-217-5757, and we'll go back to the phone lines with Dr. Cope and Dr. Sadow. But a question from Elizabeth regarding the performance thus far of Governor John Bel Edwards. Jeff Sadow, you have been somewhat critical of the governor. Do you think he's doing a good job keeping the higher education ship afloat, or is there room for improvement?
Well, and this is not exclusive to him, but he's basically staying the course, doing little to change the system, where, you know, I've always thought that there needs to be some rather substantial changes to the system, where, especially at the four-year level, we're overbuilt in terms of universities. And, of course, a governor can't make those kinds of changes by himself. He'd need the legislature and a lot of political courage and those kinds of more extensive solutions. I don't expect to see coming out of him or the legislature anytime soon. So it basically stay the course, but in my view, there needs to be some fundamental transformations of Louisiana higher education, and we're not going to get that from him or anybody else in the near future.
Yes, I think the governor is extremely well-intentioned, and I will add that the faculty leadership around the state is grateful to the governor for creating a quarterly dialogue with the chief of staff and other officials, so we're seeing a much greater respect for professional educators than we've seen in the past. That having been said, the situation is one atop the razor's edge. That is, we've got a Democratic governor, and we have a Republican legislature that creates what I suppose, to use a cliche, is gridlock. And so I agree that we're not seeing some fundamental changes. What we really need is to shake up the way the leadership is created. For example, the way and the kind of people who appear on boards of supervisors and on the boards of regents. But that's going to be a very tough go with the governor, who's in a weak position.
John in Kenilworth. John, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dr. Sadow and Dr.
Cope. Costonis. Happy to call in and always happy to listen to your program.
Thank you.
Somehow this talk about whether it was 8%, 12%, or 13% cut over the last 8 or 10 years is kind of, in many ways, missing the point. I came down to LSU as the Chancellor of the Law Center in 1998, and it's hard to describe the excitement that existed on the campus at that time, and then increased in consequence of Mark Emmert. Of course, Saban winning ball games didn't hurt at all. Chancellor Jenkins and then President Jenkins was outstanding. Mark Drennan and Steve Perry were the two major assistants to the governor, who was totally supportive of education at the time. At that time, as far as the law school budget was concerned, 54 cents of every 100 cents that was spent came from state from the state. Now that number is 21 cents of every 100 cents. I watched a situation where in the prior 10 years, we were in the same situation that we're in now. The library, the faculty, et cetera, all suffered in consequence of that period, the oil crisis from 1985 on. It became possible, and I came to LSU in 1998 because of the governor, because of the commitment of Mark and Steve Perry.
Okay, hold tight. If you'll stay on the line, Dean Costonis, we'll continue with you and Jeff Sadow and Kevin Cope. Now the news with Karen Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on 89.3 WRKF. Your number 877-217-5757. Doctors Jeff Sadow and Kevin Cope. Jeff Sadow on the LSU Shreveport campus for 27 years and Kevin Cope on the LSU Baton Rouge campus for 34 years. And they are talking about the state of higher education amid heavy budget cuts over the last decade. Again, 877-217-5757. I think we lost Dean Costonis during the break, the man who was the law school dean for several years and came to LSU back in the Mike Foster days when money was flush. And at that time, there was certainly a distinct difference in morale, as he noted. And it does make a difference when the beast is fed, Kevin Cope.
There's no question about that, and I want to stress that I'm not defending the phenomenon that I'm about to report, but it is the case now that we've reached what we pilots call the region of negative control. That is, there are many people now who are in such a state of despair that they're not willing to make even an effort with respect to LSU. They're certainly willing to make an effort to advance their careers, but if you look around and think that, well, if I give my utmost for the next 5 years, I might get a 3, 4, 4.25% raise. And then you've got options in other areas. Of course, you're going to pursue those other options. Physically, the campus at Baton Rouge is somewhat depressing. You go into the library, it looks like maybe not quite Beirut post-war, but pretty serious situation there. You wander around, you see trash that's uncollected. The people there are doing good work, but they're underfunded and undersupported. Sooner or later, too, the students that are currently paying the tuition are going to get that message as well and look elsewhere.
How are things on the LSU Shreveport campus, Dr. Sadow?
Oh, well, it's, you know, we've been battling with enrollment issues, at least on campus, residential, say, I guess, educational issues. Our online programs are actually doing quite well, but, you know, there has been no growth. We actually had our peak about 30 years ago when we had the most students on campus. And our faculty is at LSU in Baton Rouge has seen a decline. We're maybe about 10 to 15% over the last decade. But you know, there's a number of people, again, like lifers like myself, who for whatever you know, for our different reasons, we stick around and we keep trying to do our jobs. It's you know, we have a bit different mission at LSUS. We're more of a teaching institution. We really focus on that with a number of students are first generation college students. So that sense of mission is something that and sense of purpose drives a lot of people on campus.
All right, 877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. A couple of questions from listeners. Here's one from Leonard Joseph, who says, if LSU had educated us in the state of Louisiana over the past 150 years, LSU would have no financial problems today, nor would the state. Kevin Coe?
There is some truth in that. However, the state also needs to be receptive, and I think we need to keep the numbers in proportion as well. That is, LSU can admit at any given time or have in its undergraduate cadre somewhere between 25 and 32,000 students, gradually growing. Population of Louisiana is roughly 4 million. It would take a long time for LSU alone to educate everyone. That's one reason why we need a broad-based, statewide, multi-campus sort of higher education infrastructure, so that we can reach out and do that. By the same token, of course, we need to find ways to educate those who are in K through 12 education about college. That is, I'm not convinced that our counseling operation is adequately supported either, so we don't perhaps see all of the motivations. And finally, I would add that we need to do a better job in acquainting students with all that they can learn about in college. That is, everybody wants to go and become a medical doctor or an engineer or this or that, but there are so many other lines of work that could be beneficial both to the state and to this world that are not being stressed within our culture.
Kevin Cope, now Jeff Sadow. What do you think, Dr. Sadow?
Yeah, I think there is a history in the state that did not place a high degree of emphasis on higher education, on receiving college degrees. When Louisiana came into the industrial age and with the discovery of oil and its processing, it was easy. I don't know if the word easy is a word, but it was quite possible for somebody with a high school education and maybe not even that to go out and get a pretty good job in that industry. So, you know, there was never quite this emphasis, as we've seen in other states, on higher education. And, you know, one of the disappointing things, I think how that's reflected, is in the amount of giving to endowments or universities, comparatively, LSU, to our neighbors. You know, we look at, there's some really stunning statistics out there. The state of Texas, with five times the population of Louisiana, the University of Texas Foundation is 51 times larger than LSU's. A&M is 22 times larger. But, you don't even have to go far. You look at Arkansas, the university there has got the endowment with the state with a smaller population, four times of LSU's. So, I think there is that problem out there, and that's a cultural change that would have to occur over a very long period of time. I think it's in the works, but we're clearly got a long ways to go.
Gaston and Goodwood. Hi, Gaston. You're on with Dr. Cope and Dr. Sadow.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you taking the call. A couple little points. One is, you know, when the Governor Foster was in, we did pass that we started implementing the gambling thing, which that money was supposed to go to education, but that baby's out with the bath. Secondly, you know, you're selling information. You don't need buildings anymore. You need to step up, go ahead and lease out some of those buildings, or maybe bring in some pre-K to LSU's campus and start educating them from the early age. Get rid of the top, start the bottoms, and then you have more people graduating and less people incarcerated.
Well, Gaston and Goodwood, in addition to having a wonderful alliterative name, Gaston and Goodwood, your idea of taking tops and starting at the bottom has some literary merit to it. There I would suggest that although Dr. Sadow is right that we certainly have had some major advances in online education, it's not really the only solution. For one, college in the United States has long enjoyed, since I suppose the time of that educational philosopher Dewey, the role partly of affecting the cultural transition. There is a merit in coming to a campus, living there for 4 years, experiencing the life in a learning community, and otherwise becoming an educated citizen. Of course, that can happen at other phases in life. We have plenty of mature, non-traditional students, as they're now called. Non-traditional is now a synonym for old, I suppose, but there are real reasons to have some bricks and mortar campuses.
All right, here's a question to Dr. Sadow from Gary. He says, cuts to higher ed in Louisiana aren't occurring in some higher ed vacuum. Louisiana is in a regional and national competition and losing, and Dr. Sadow grossly underestimates the magnitude of the cuts to higher ed. What do you think, Dr. Sadow?
Well, I gave the numbers, and if you look at comparatively to the region or the country as a whole, you see in most states the same thing happening, that there's been cuts to direct state aid to higher education. So you know, in that sense, you know, Louisiana is not going against the current. It's the way the current's going itself, and if we were to start increasing that in a dramatic fashion, then that would be contrary to what's happening. Now, whether that should be what's happening is another matter, but that's what is happening. So, again, the numbers are what they are, and I would argue in a comparative sense it's not unlike what's going on in other places.
All right, here's a question from Adam about an observation made by Dean Costonis, who called in a little while ago regarding Nick Saban and football helping LSU in the early O's. Is the football program driving the boat, Kevin Cope, on your campus?
I think it drives the boat with regard to a certain set of passengers, maybe those that are booked into steerage. However, I think there is a little bit of a misconception about what football and other sports programs do for the university. Yes, they are huge public relations advantages, no question about that. But the economic impact is somewhat exaggerated. The athletic department at LSU, of course, gives $7 to $8 million to the university, but part of that is in exchange for services, and not much of it filters up into the research project. So, and of course, very little of it reaches the other campuses. Also, statewide, the athletic project across the state runs about a $35 to $40 million deficit. So if you say LSU is pulling in whatever, $120 million a year, then you take that $40 million that you pay across the state out of it, you see that it's a net deficit to have football in Louisiana.
All right. Would you like to see a football program at LSU Shreveport, Dr. Sadow?
Well, be a nice recruiting tool, but no, it'd be a little bit expensive. It's difficult for us to hang on to the sports that we have, although we actually do very well in NAIA and in a couple of them. But you know, yeah, the LSU is in Baton Rouge. It's unusual in that it's one of the very few athletic programs in the country to actually make money. There's only about a dozen schools where that happens. LSU is one of them. But, you know, the fact of the matter is you do look at all programs across the entire state, and it's a deficit. And, you know, one of those little quirks, if we, you know, go back to endowments, is that actually the giving for athletics at LSU through the various foundations is actually higher than the giving to the academic endowment. And that's unusual, at least in the SEC, the schools that report figures. That's the only school where that's the case.
Final thoughts, Dr. Cope?
Well, I think the final thought is that nothing is final. That is, we do have some good things going at the universities. For example, on the LSU campus and at the LSU system, there is an effort to create a new strategic plan that's going to try and uplift the people of Louisiana and address a lot of the problems we've seen here.
Well, thank you for joining us, Dr. Jeff Sadow. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Jeff, and
sure.
Dr. Kevin Cope. Thanks for joining us today. And coming next, we'll visit with novelist Jarrett Kobach. He hit it big last year with I Hate the Internet, and he is back with The Future Won't Be Long. This is Jim Inkster, and our guest is Jarrett Kobach, a Turkish-American writer living in California, the author of the novella Atta and the novel I Hate the Internet, an international bestseller that has appeared or is scheduled to appear in 7 languages. And when Jarrett Kobach decided to publish the novel I Hate the Internet through his own publishing press, he never imagined he would have one of the most surprising literary successes of 2016. This has been an amazing voyage the last year, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has taken me to places that I could not imagine.
And when you went to San Francisco and unearthed this work, I would imagine the home of the tech world was somewhat receptive, but also somewhat cautious in receiving your words.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I haven't gotten that much of a response from the tech world. I mean, I've gotten it from people who feel oppressed by it in San Francisco, but the tech world itself hasn't really said that much to me about it. I did get shouted at a reading at City Lights Books in North Beach, though.
What caused that?
Someone was very upset that I had insulted Twitter.
That you had insulted Twitter. Imagine that.
Yeah, so I got heckled by a drunken beatnik for about 12 minutes.
Well, why do you hate the internet?
Well, I should say that the title was sort of intended to sound like a 15-year-old sneering into Twitter. But the idea of the book was just, you know, to look at the rhetoric that has surrounded the tech industry. And, you know, it has to be said, too, this was all pre-Trump, because I think the rhetoric has really changed quite a bit since then. But, you know, Facebook was being presented as a tool that would somehow save humanity, or was fostering political revolutions in the Middle East. And at the same time, I was living in San Francisco, and you could just see the terrible effect it was having on people who had been in the city for decades, who had to leave their homes, who had to go somewhere else. And something about the disconnect of that really made me crazy. And then it turned into a bile-filled book about the tech industry.
Well, the latest work is The Future Won't Be Long, and it is apparent that you also have a distinct knowledge of New York City.
Yeah, I lived in the East Village for about 10 years, from about 1996 forward. And I got to the East Village just in time to sort of watch one of its historical moments die, which was this time when it was really cheap and it was full of wild artists and they were all having these really wild lives. And, you know, I saw enough of it to realize that something was being lost and then wanted to investigate that in a book.
Well, the book, I Hate the Internet, was really a groundbreaking book to get reviewed in the New York Times, and we're talking about a self-published venture. This just doesn't happen, does it?
I think it's possibly the second or third self-published book they'd ever reviewed. I think it's the first self-published novel, maybe. I'm not sure, but yeah, the point is it never, ever happens, and it was utterly shocking when it did.
How is that experience and the reception, and largely a very positive one, affected the work that you're doing now?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer, because I think it's still working its way through, but it's a bewildering experience to go from a book that had very modest ambitions into this thing that turned into an international bestseller, and have all of that happen really within the span of about a year. I've yet to go crazy from it, so I think that's probably good. The you know, we'll see what it turns into in the work itself.
The Future Won't Be Long has a caustic eye as it examines the East Village on the precipice of gentrification. And this is at a time, you mentioned President Trump. He certainly was an active part of New York life in the 80s and 90s. How do you weave all this together?
It is, it's ultimately the story of a friendship between a young man and a young woman, and the friendship happens over the span of about 11 years, and then the history is the backdrop to the friendship, which is how I think most people actually experience history, right? Like, we live our lives, and then things happen adjacent to those lives.
Can a heterosexual man write from the point of view of a gay character?
Sure, why not?
I don't see any reason why not, but is it often done?
I don't know. I mean, you know, first of all, I would probably describe myself more as heteroflexible than heterosexual. I don't know. I don't think straight dudes really, as far as we've come in terms of representation and discussion of sexuality, I think most straight male writers are still sort of this very butch, Hemingway-esque model. And I am not. I'm not butch. You know, I'm interested in the investigation and the interrogation of all of this, and, you know, want to preach the gospel of gay sex across many a book, if I can.
Now, Hemingway and Norman Mailer would probably wince at what you just said.
Yeah, probably, but we've found out details about both of their sex lives that would suggest that other things were going on.
But maybe not that. They certainly had active lives, but you're saying there's usually a story behind the story. That's what makes a good novel, and you're not afraid to go places others have not.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, is it a brave new world for you, Jarrett, when we're talking about this reception you have? You're now recognized as a top-flight writer. Where does that take you from here?
That's a very good question. I think we'll see how that plays out with the release of this book. But yeah, I mean, it's weird. I went from being one of the least read writers in America to being at least modestly read in an extraordinarily compressed period of time. And it's a very fortunate thing. I was very lucky. But to live it, you then have to constantly be readjusting your understanding of yourself. You know, I still think of myself as this guy who's publishing with these really tiny presses, and that's clearly just not the case anymore.
The New York of 30 years ago that you have studied so earnestly, how does it compare with the East Village of today?
I was just down there a couple of days ago. It's like a different world. It's unrecognizable. It has been, everything that had been there has more or less been chased out and been replaced by like a kind of international shopping mall driven by global finance.
Is this an area that you'll continue to write about?
I'm not sure. I mean, maybe I could write about something earlier than what's in the book, but what's happening now, I have no connection to. I don't understand it at all. That's someone else's book.
Well, for those who have heard about I Hate the Internet and are planning to read The Future Won't Be Long, is there any kind of message that you're trying to convey, or is this just entertainment?
No, I think there is a secret message to both books, which is that we should all try to cultivate strong friendships, because in moments of either personal or public adversity, the only thing that will really save us is our friends and our friendships. And so we should probably try to treat the people who like us better than we do.
Being tethered to our smartphones, does that take away the capacity for friendship?
To a certain extent. I mean, I don't know. I have some friends that I only talk to through my cell phone who are still remain very close because people have been dispersed. But yeah, I think for a lot of people, it really can be this blocking mechanism. I mean, we live in an era where the idea of friendship has been redefined into a sort of social media game, and that cannot help. That cannot be anything but destructive.
Well, we thank you for joining us, Jarrett Kobeck. I Hate the Internet made him one of the most talked about writers of last year, and The Future Won't Be Long is basically going to cement him as a writer for years to come. So thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure, Jarrett.
Thank you for having me.
And come tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with J.R. Ball, executive editor of the Baton Rouge Business Report. J.R. Ball, continuing the discussion we had with Drs. Cope and Sadow from LSU today, believes that universities, LSU in particular, should charge more, let's say, for a petroleum engineering degree than for a journalism degree, because the pay that students who graduate receive when they get out from certain degrees is much higher than for others. We'll talk with him. And also, the remarkable Loudon Wainwright III, what a life he's had on the music scene, and he's written about it in liner notes. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening. Have a good day and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.